Okay, thank you very much, Alistair and Brent, for that. So things might get a little bit noisy just while I take everyone off mute, and this is your opportunity to ask Brent or Alistair any questions you may have. So hang on a second, I'll just unmute everyone. If you do have a question, please state your organisation and name before you do it. So go ahead on the conference here if anyone has any questions. Well, in that case, maybe I'll kick off with one. This is a question for Alistair. Alistair, just in your experience with Zespri and that, do you think that labelling products would actually be a useful way of informing customers of the water used in production of something like kiwifruit?
I think that there's quite a bit of debate about that at the moment, and with the carbon footprinting, and there's some work being done both here and also offshore on looking at how effectively to communicate information such as carbon footprints to consumers. And I think we'll be looking for a lead from that for the water footprinting. And I think Walmart, when they're looking at their environmental footprint, are trying to also think of an effective way of getting maybe up to 5 different environmental indicators across to consumers. So it's probably a little bit early to say how best we can get that information across to consumers.
Right. I mentioned this research that the UK government's doing through DEFRA there. Is the UK in particular taking a lead on this around the world?
Certainly from our feedback, I mean, the original ideas behind water footprinting came from various NGOs, but as a government agency, DEFRA has certainly taken a major lead on it.
Right, okay. Thanks for that.
Can I just get sorry, it's Margot White from New Zealand Geographic. Can I just get clarity on that? So no one's actually kind of doing any of these, carbon footprinting or food miles. No one's actually labelling anything that's conveying that information to consumers yet.
Oh, no, there are some labels which have been tried. In Japan, there's some labelling going through. In the UK, you can find labelling on, I think, Walker's Crisps were one of the first ones to put a carbon footprint label. Thailand, they're experimenting with a label using traffic light indicators. There's a number of labels being trialled, but at the moment there's no international standard for carbon footprinting. There's one which is being worked through with ISO, and likewise that's being followed by the virtual water footprinting. And
right.
and for exporters going into markets like Europe or Asia, what we don't want is a whole plethora of different labels in there, because we'll add quite a lot of confusion to consumers.
Yeah.
But there are labels being trialled, and obviously some of those will end up possibly becoming more of an international standard.
But those ones that are being trialled, is there any evidence that consumers are going for it?
Oh, well, there's quite a bit of research happening to quantify that. So,
right.
So it's a very new emerging area.
Right, okay, thank you.
It's Brent here. In the United Kingdom, there is already one agreed carbon footprint protocol called the PAS 2050 from the British Standards Institute, and there is under quite rapid development now a similar protocol through the international, through ISO. But Tesco's, the British retailer, have actually invested £25 million in a sustainable consumers institute at Manchester University to examine those kind of questions, Margot.
Right, thank you.
Thanks, Margot, and thanks, Brent, for that answer there. Any other questions on the conference?
Hi, it's Sarah Barnett here from The Listener.
Go ahead, Sarah.
I don't know if it's a backwards or forwards from labelling. Are there moves to kind of try and set what would be an acceptable standard? Because I'm thinking about going to the supermarket and looking at a litre of milk that has a sticker on it that says this has a footprint of 500 litres of water or whatever, and that's almost meaningless unless you have some kind of benchmark for what is an acceptable water footprint. So is there work around that, kind of, what's a good sustainable water footprint for a particular product?
I'll have a go at that. And in my slide, I identified the Food Ethics Council in the United Kingdom, and they have actually gone into that kind of question. And their recommendation is essentially that rather than actually having the kind of data that you have said there, you know, 500 litres for a litre, what does that mean? They have actually gone for something like the Marine Stewardship, where there is a sort of a around that this product was developed under good environmental stewardship.
Right.
But that's a debate that's ongoing.
Right, thank you.
Similar question in some ways. Howard Keane here, New Zealand Rural Press. Who do you think would judge whether water use would be have a detrimental effect on a producer country, you know, let's say Australia?
So who would judge that?
Who would judge that?
Well, that's like that sort of scattergram that I put up. That was an NGO, essentially the Worldwide Fund for Nature, sort of providing that information. But then again, in a local context, you know, stewardship of our water resources under the RMA is the responsibility of regional council. So you could see that this could work in tandem with wise use of our water resources.
I mean, who would judge that internationally? Like, for British consumers, for example, say that water use at the moment was detrimental to the Australian environment, for example.
Well, that's in the eye of the beholder, possibly. But the information is put forward there. And the interesting one, as I didn't point it out on that scattergram, is that Australia actually sits reasonably close to New Zealand in terms of its water stress index, which seems a little bit peculiar at first instance. But, of course, the north of Australia has very, very large amounts of water available, so that's a national water footprint. So there's a lot of debate to be had around that in terms of national water footprint relative to, say, a product footprint where you might be looking at the water stress index of where it might have been produced.
And some of those decisions will also be made by retailer groups as well. And I think Walmart's been talking to a number of the other retailers around coming up with a common a standard or view of an environmental footprint. And I think it would start rolling back down at a product level, so it would look at a particular product and where that product's grown in relation to rainfall, what's the irrigation, water extraction required for that crop, and then what impact of runoff and leachate from a crop is going to have on water resources. So it's quite possible that it may be on a product by product basis going through to retailers.
Okay, thanks, Alistair.
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Liam Baldwin from National Business Review. Could this mean then that countries that are relatively blessed with water, such as New Zealand, could develop a competitive edge over countries like Australia that are manufacturing similar products and exporting to the same markets?
Do you want to have a go at that, Alistair?
Well, I guess the certainly if you look in the UK, the UK producers saw virtual water footprinting as a potential competitive advantage based on their environment. For producers in New Zealand, I mean it's a whole new area, and potentially it does provide a competitive advantage. We need to start working through the case studies and, as I said, look at the risks and opportunities which emerge from that. But in general, you'd say that we would appear to be quite competitive.
Over and above that competitive advantage, there is also a sort of a developing area of academic interest around the role of virtual water trade on the sustainability of global water resources, and so that is an interesting area, you know, that, where you would develop products or where water was available, and although the virtual water content may be high, the water stress index in the region it's produced is not high. So yes, that would lend competitive advantage, not only presently but also into the future, where climate change for New Zealand is going to be reasonably benign relative to water.
Yeah, it's Murray Gibbs speaking here from Water New Zealand. I've come into this conversation reasonably late in the piece, so I may be repeating what's already been said, but I'd just like to reinforce those comments that really you have to consider the thing in the background of the individual country and its water availability. And if you look at what's going on in the Murray-Darling Basin in Australia, where people are producing cotton and dairying, the questions about the sustainability of that. You look at China, where 4/5 of their cereal production comes from irrigated irrigation, and they're mining fossil aquifers under the North China Plain, and you compare that with our production systems in New Zealand, where we're only abstracting a minuscule amount of annual water runoff, around about 2%, as compared with the annual runoff internationally, where the figure's over 50%. The context of our water situation in New Zealand puts us in an extremely good position, I would suggest, going forward.
I don't know. So Murray, was it?
Yeah, Murray Gibb, Water New Zealand.
Can you see my presentation? Because that's I think, what I've talked about. I don't know whether you saw my presentation.
No, I didn't. So I qualified my remarks by saying I came in later on in the piece.
Just reinforce, I don't know whether you can see your screen, but I've put up, I don't know whether everyone can see it, I've put up the amount of water that New Zealand exports to the United Kingdom relative to the water stress index of our country, which is just 1%. Compared to, say, South Africa, Italy, Thailand, Spain, over there, which do it at two orders of magnitude greater in terms of water stress index.
Yeah.
It's Margot White from New Zealand Geographic again. Going back, clarifying on that point again, so the actual mathematical model that you're using to determine this water stress, has that been internationally agreed on, or is that still being worked on and modified as well? In terms of how you measure your green water and your blue water and your grey water and what it all means.
That figure that is up there comes from the Worldwide Fund for Nature, and that was for the United Kingdom. So they'd used a standard how much water has been withdrawn by looking at records and see on the virtual water document that the Royal Society have put out. You can see the map of Canterbury. You can see the Regional Council has provided the allocations there. And so those calculations can be done reasonably in a straightforward manner.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for that, Margot. Any other questions on the conference?
Paul Easton here from the Dominion Post.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
I just was wondering, any idea of the time frame, like how long will it take before we may see labels on food? Water labels?
I think Walmart, for example, is given about 5 years to be able to work through to develop this environmental footprint. If you look at what's happening with the carbon footprinting, there's been work done on it over the last 2 to 3 years, and we're still, as you indicated, there's still a range of footprints with labels which are being evaluated in the marketplace. So it's probably within that 5 year time frame.
So if you look at the Royal Society document, notes that the debate around water sustainability is lagging about 5 to 10 years behind that of carbon.
Yeah, it's Murray Gibb here, Water New Zealand again. It's quite interesting. If you go out 20 years and look at stress on the system in terms of feeding the world's population with increased population
increased urbanisation and increased living standards, and there's two schools of thought around this. The Food and Agriculture Organisation says there is enough land and water available to feed the increased population, the 40 or 50% that's going to occur over the next 20 or 30 years. There's another school of thought articulated by Sir John Beddington, the Chief Science Advisor for the UK, who made a speech that was widely reported recently, saying that in 20 years' time, given the three drivers, increased urbanisation, and 2009 is the crossover period from when the world was more rurally based to more urban based, increased living standards and the change in diets and the consumer buying patterns that occur with that, and just the increased population generally, Sir John Beddington argued that we are heading for a perfect storm in 20 years' time, and the limiting factor is water. And I guess there's a view that the water stress is going to cause a problem probably or possibly earlier than the energy stress carbon thing for the world. So if that is the case, then of course it puts New Zealand in an extraordinarily good position.
Okay, thanks for that. Murray, any other questions there on the conference?
Well, it's Neil Wallace from the Otago Daily Times here. Given what you've been saying about how New Zealand's going to be well placed, there's still a lot of criticism about our use of irrigation, and seeing some documents that came out from the Royal Society talking about the amount of land that's being irrigated in Canterbury and the potential that can be that still exists there. Is that not going to pose a problem on the international scene?
Can I answer that one? Murray Gibbs speaking again. Just some facts there. At the moment, Canterbury is abstracting something like 8% of the water that flows across and under the plain. Internationally, something like 50 or 54% of annual runoff is abstracted. It's been estimated that if Canterbury wanted to irrigate, I think 800,000 hectares, which is two-thirds of the plain, they would only be abstracting 14%. If you throw in harvesting and storage, then it's eminently feasible. The question is, can you do it in sustained quality? There are two schools of thought on that one. One which says no, and the other one which says yes. If you look at the science, while we're not there yet in terms of applying the science, it is pointing in the direction of being able to quite significantly intensify production in a sustainable way. And I'd commend people going to read the Canterbury Strategic Water Study report that's just been put out in the last week or so.
Okay, thanks for that. Any other questions there?
Can we get an answer for that one from the two panellists? Please, it's Dave Williams at the press here.
Well, that's probably something that you probably better go back to Murray on. But I would about or the regional council. But I would just bring up this slide that I put on before in terms of the three colours of virtual water. You can use the blue water to maintain the green water use. But as you will have noted, it's been quite topical of late about the agrochemicals leaking at the bottom, the grey water that compromises the quality, not the quantity, of our water. So that's where we have to use good science and good practice to make sure that we use our water resources well, so we don't compromise quality, not only quantity.
And Brent, Dave Williams again, what do you say about the ability to put on an extra 300,000 hectares of irrigation in Canterbury, for example, and what the effect would be for that grey water?
Well, I think that's a question that needs to go to the Environment Secretary. It's a little bit beyond my ken.
Okay, thanks for that. Any other questions on the conference? Okay, in that case, look, I think we'll bring things to a close. I'd just like to thank Brent and Alistair for their presentations there.